Tonight on Elephant Talk Revisited, we talk with Dr. Pierre Blaise, who discusses the facts and fiction of breast implants. Dr. Blaise also talks about Health Canada's recent decision to lift the ban on silicone implants. Julie has the introduction.
Dr. Blaise was previously for 14 years working in the Department of National Health and Welfare at the Government of Canada, which is now Health Canada, and he was a senior scientific advisor. Hello, Dr. Blaise.
Good afternoon.
Thanks very much for being on the line.
You're welcome.
So maybe you could just tell us what you're up to now and what kind of a business you run or consultancy that you run at the moment.
Well, I operate a consulting service which deals with statistics of failure for high-risk medical products and also manufacturing quality for medical devices. I've been in this business, in effect, even before I was with National Health and Welfare, and I've been still in a similar business after my departure from health and welfare. So, in effect, the program I run has got almost 20 years of background on collecting medical equipment which somehow failed, and more often failed within people's bodies, and deriving information from what we find so that we can improve the product or at least reduce the risks.
And so what is it that you see as the most commonly failed medical device?
Problems that deal with manufacturing are comparatively rare for medical devices nowadays. They were at one time a major concern, with one exception. Breast implants seem to be a world of their own, like most cosmetic surgery implants. These products don't really fulfill criteria of medical, high-quality medical equipment, and never have, certainly since the 1950s. And even today, there's still open questions as to whether they embody sufficient quality to be used for non-life-supporting purposes.
And so recently, Health Canada has approved the use, once again, of silicone implants. And they say that the technology these days is much better than it used to be. And that's part of the reason why they've decided to approve these devices. What have you seen in your research? What is your opinion on that?
Well, it's a bit of a, well, it's an illusion. Basically, the technology is exactly the same. The materials are still the same, although it comes from other sources. There are other providers for the raw materials. Basically, the same people who were around in the 60s, 70s, and 80s making breast implants are still around. Only the names of the companies have changed as a result of multiple acquisitions, bankruptcies, problems, movement of the companies abroad, and so on and so forth. As far as I'm concerned, and as far as most people who deal with this sector are concerned, nothing is new in that sector other than the means of making the products, which are now much faster, much more automated, and of course much more widely sold.
So you get sent a lot of failed implants, or what are called explants. Where do you get these failed implants from, and what do you find?
They come from the world over. We get them from Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the U.S., Latin America. They come more often from firms who are interested in following up on adverse events, or from physicians, and occasionally from patients themselves who donate the implants for research after the implants being removed. We have more than, I personally have seen probably more than 10,000 implants of used for cosmetic surgery. And their manufacturing dates vary from as early as the 1950s right up to literally last month. What we find is pretty well the same. It doesn't seem to matter where the implants come from or when they were made. They embody a technology which is widely different from what is found in other medical devices. They're made in high volumes. The quality of fabrication, as reflected by what it looks like, is very average, very mundane, very poor. In terms of what they do over the long term, they inevitably drag the patient into additional surgery. They have a chronic damaging effect on the chest, which is both mechanical and chemical, And they also alter the chemistry, the anatomy, the physiology of the chest and everything that is around the implant. After all, a breast implant is only about 2 centimeters from at least 3 major life-supporting organs. So it doesn't take the proverbial rocket scientist to figure out that they constitute a major potential risk. And if they're poorly made, then the risks are much magnified. And again, this is not news. It's been like that for more than half a century.
Now, some medical research over the years has suggested that silicone is an inert substance within the body. Have you seen any evidence of how silicone behaves in the body?
Oh, yes. There's thousands of individual research studies on this, of which a few hundred have been published. Some are part of corporate records. Firstly, it's a total misconception. There's no such thing, quote, as silicone in the singular. It's thousands of different compounds mixed very much like rubbers. There is no more reality to saying silicone without an S to it than saying, quote, car tire. There's enormous variations between silicones. Some are extremely toxic, and some of these molecules are used in context of defense. At the other extreme, properly made and well-designed products that are made of specialized silicones can be very good prosthetic systems and can provide the user with a very good replacement, at least for some years, to get around an infirmity or something like that. There's no reality to saying that it's a single product. And you would need, in the case of breast implants, even the process that makes breast implants does not ensure uniformity from implant to implant of the same batch. And we have instances where, quote, the silicones are from the same implant and yet have different properties from point to point. It's extremely variable.
So is there no such thing as a pure silicone substance?
There are thousands of pure silicone substance. Pure silicone-based substance, some of them are used in chemical warfare. Pure chemical substances made with silicone-containing molecules, also at the other extreme, are sufficiently good, if properly made, to perform in life support machines. It's a wide range. It's like saying, quote, silicone is like saying a carbon compound. It has no meaning within the chemical and the physical sciences. What medicine implies silicones to be is also very much non-uniform. It's no more descriptive a term than saying a rubber.
So do you think this variability leads to a difficulty in analyzing the substance and being able to determine its safety?
Yes. In fact, a study, quote, that purports to analyze silicones, unquote, and their effect on the body is not a definitive thing by any means. It's only a guideline that is applicable to the compound they actually studied. It's a very strange way of looking at things. You cannot say on the basis of anything published to date, and that's half a century of publications, say blanket that implants made of silicone are by necessity demonstrated as safe. It is a point-by-point, case-by-case issue which has to be dealt with. This is quite unlike products that are employed for other parts of medicine. You cannot compare a breast implant to a knee implant, to a hip implant, to a brain shunt, or to even a catheter. They're different products.
And is that because the implants are put into the chest area?
No. Breast implants are the product of a technology and a way of thinking that evolved independently of the medical sciences over a very long time. It seems that people who purchase breast implants do not demand the same thing of those things as other individuals who are in medicine. It's a strange way to look at it, but in a way it's understandable, because the role of a breast implant is not the same as a heart valve. A heart valve has to work very hard for its life. It moves many times. It has to resist impact. It has to essentially keep the patient blood system functioning. A breast implant doesn't need to do that. A breast implant just needs to be there. It just needs to cause volume increase. This is the most basic requirement. And yet, the breast implants we have seen over the years do not even do that. They basically break down into different parts, and the parts somehow affect the surrounding tissue in ways that are not normal.
And so is it true that silicone breast implants basically went onto the market in the early 60s without any long-term testing or studies on humans?
Correct. And to this day, even if there were such studies, the studies would apply specifically only to the batch of the product that has been studied. It would not apply to anything before, and most probably nothing after.
Because there's great variability in silicone.
Correct. They are what we would call an article of commerce with quality assurance and fabrication requirements, which are very modest in comparison to medical products of a more serious nature.
And something I've uncovered in my research is that the FDA effectively grandfathered in silicone implants. Can you explain what that means?
Grandfathering is an American term. It exists in Canada. All it means is that anything, any practice, any product which predates the time when a law or a rule was enacted, according to the game, the rules of the game, such a product or such a practice, it cannot be and traditionally is not regarded as subject to the new law. See, for example, people sold castor oil for constipation since the turn of the century, maybe even before. There were no laws against it, so all kinds of people sold castor oil. In the 1930s, food and drug laws were born in Canada and in the U.S., and all of a sudden castor oil became subject to law. But the new laws did not affect the products that were already on the market. Now, every time, at intervals of about 10 years, food and drug laws, which, by the way, is the same as laws that govern medical devices such as breast implants, every 10 years there's kind of a renewal and a bit of a tightening of existing rules so as to improve what is perceived as problems. So anything done before, you can still do the same, and on the basis that the product is grandfathered, and that's exactly what happened for breast implants. The breast implants were around before 76, before companies had to demonstrate they were safe. In Canada, in 1983, there was a change in the regulation which made breast implants for the first time subject to review by a government agency. But any product sold before that was deemed to be exempt. After 1992, all products pertinent to the so-called breast implant of a gel type were placed under moratorium. But the moratorium didn't forbid the use of the implant. You could still get a gel implant after 1992 by simply saying or asking your physician to classify you as a needy patient, the so-called the special need provision. And under these provisions, Health and Welfare Canada authorized the sale and the implantation of certainly more than 50,000 implants.
So in many ways, this new approval by Health Canada of silicone implants is sort of a, excuse the pun, but it's sort of a cosmetic thing?
It's not even pragmatic. It doesn't change anything other than making the implants what's the word for this? Whereas before, the surgeon was compelled to warn the patient that the implants constituted major risks and that they were participating in some kind of a controlled study, and that the physician had to warn the patient that he had to get a special authority to put the implants in. The new rule, the new decision to release the implants for wide use, remove even that. So now plastic surgeons, agencies that deal with promotion of plastic surgery, can go forth and advertise the implantation for any reason, with basically the impression that the implants are perfectly good and they have some kind of a seal of approval. But that is not so. If you look at the fine details of Health Canada's rules that surround the release of the breast implants, there are lots of things. There are conditions that have to be fulfilled. And anyone who is thinking of getting an implant, I would strongly advise them to look at the website, or at least to ask Health Canada the reasons why they should examine very carefully what the surgeon tells them, or for that matter, if it's an advertisement, what the advertisement contains, because it is not a blanket approval.
I just want to remind our listeners that they're listening to CHLY, and we are speaking with Dr. Pierre Blaise, who was with the Department of Health and Welfare for 14 years in the government and is now running a medical consultancy. Another question I had was regarding saline implants. A lot of people have heard the problems with silicone, and so saline has always been on the market pretty much from the 60s in Canada and in the U.S. and has been viewed as a safe alternative. What have you seen in your line of work?
Well, it's not true, first of all, not even as an incidental statement. Saline implants have been surrounded with problems from the moment that they were released into the marketplace. In the early 80s, even surgeons in Montreal and Toronto sued breast implant companies making salines because of damage to their reputation. The products were simply unworthy of implantation. There are several cases like this. Eventually, in the early 80s, the saline implants almost disappeared. By the 1992, when the moratorium came, the saline implants were the only thing that you could really promote and put into users without requiring a special authority. So all of a sudden, saline implants became, quote, very good, unquote, at least according to some people. But nothing really was changed. The saline implants embody major technical problems. They could be made comparatively safe, but their so-called track record is not good. And it's not a matter of where they came from. We've seen a lot of problems with saline. The major one is that the valve, unlike the silicone gel implants, the saline implants have a valve in which the surgeon will pump water containing some salt into the implant in order to make it billow up to a round shape. Well, this valve is not reliable. It allows both saline to leak out, and it also allows some of the patient's body fluids to come in. And the long-term consequences of this are basically the same as what you would have if you were to buy a bottle of drinking water where the cap doesn't fit right.
So what happens to the implant when it is inside, the saline implant when it is inside a woman's body?
Well, blood cells, proteins from her enter the implant, and sooner or later, viable microorganisms will get in too if they're not already there. And the microorganisms will use her body proteins as food, and they do what the Lord intended them to do. They go forth and procreate, so that over a number of years, the fluid inside saline implant becomes contaminated by bacterial, fungal byproducts. And in some cases, the amount is so large that you can see it with the eye unaided at a distance of 2 meters.
This isn't a removed implant that you're looking at?
Oh, yes. We've seen many of those. We've had, our collection includes studies on more than 500 saline implants removed after, some cases, 20 years to as little as a month. The longer the implant is in, the more contaminated it is on average. Occasionally, we find some that remain clean, but it's very rare.
So most of the implants that you receive that are saline are contaminated with microorganisms?
Microorganisms or rotting tissue from the patient.
So what kind of effect does this have on a woman's health when these things are inside of her body?
It has not been formally studied. The nearest studies that resemble that are studies on abscesses, what are called sterile or non-sterile abscesses of large volume. There were studies during the war years and before World War II about the effect of these abscesses, in which there is decaying tissue. And surprisingly enough, this type of injury is well known. It even has names, and it turns out to be immunity to tissue. It's a process which enhances the immunity of the patient against whatever tissue becomes entrapped in her implant or her abscess, as the case may be. Basically, these implants function very much like long-term chronic abscesses. And this, again, is not new. This is so old that you would go back to the 1920s in medical material or military journals, and you would find that information.
You're saying that a lot of the microorganisms and bacteria and things get in through the valve. Is the bag itself, does that also permit the passage of nutrients in and stuff out?
If the bag is well made, and there are a few implants where the bag occasionally seems to be impermeable, the bag does not allow proteins to leak through. It allows water to go through. Think of the holes, if you want to do it that way, but the pores within the silicone shell are too small to allow bigger molecules. So what happens over time, if the valve is leaky, and as the patient moves around, pulses from the movement cause her body fluids to enter the implant. Now, conversely, as the implant becomes fuller, it allows water to leak out of the bag, so that in effect the bag acts as a means of concentrating decaying tissue. And this is why we see older implants with very large amounts of collected solids.
I read on the Health Canada website that they were saying a lot of the valves and the bags and stuff today are in saline implants are of higher quality. Most recently, have you seen any?
This is absolutely nonsense. I've not seen that, but it's possible that they would have made that statement. The valves that are used on saline implants made today are the same valves which were used for the first time on saline implants on or about 1976. Not only that, about 80% of the saline implants, no matter who makes them, what company or where, the valves come from the same plant. These valves haven't changed for years.
Hi, Dr. Blade. I'm Julie's co-host, James. What I'm wondering in all this is, when Health Canada recently decided to lift the ban, what reasons or justification, I guess we could say, did they give? Or did they just say, hey, go ahead and use them now, they're safe?
That's a very good question. Here is my perception on it based on the time I was there, and also based on the fact that I have worked with many other governments. I've worked with the U.S. government. I've made presentations to the U.S. Congress, to the FDA, to the Australian authorities, and elsewhere. Basically, it goes like this. Canada, the U.S., and Britain are linked together by what is called a tripartite agreement. Under the tripartite agreement, matters such as health policy, epidemiology, infection control, medical devices, drugs, and so on, there is a committee or an organism which links the three countries so as to make the rules approximately equivalent across each country. Now, the U.S., in its wisdom, the FDA, introduced rules which would make gel implants usable again for cosmetic purposes, and they made that decision almost a year ago. They reinforced this decision very recently, in fact, just a few days ago, almost at the same time as Health Canada. Now, Britain will probably be doing the same within about a week. So, in effect, we're looking not truly at a Canadian policy, but at a policy of the industrialized countries, which for one reason or another have decided that there's enough of a constituency of people who want those things back on the market for whatever reason. And the governments together have said, well, we know they're a bag of problems. We know there'll be a lot of adverse effects, but they want it. So as far as we're concerned, if we tell the patients that there will be problems, then we have done our duty. This is one way to look at health protection that I do not agree with, and a lot of people dissent about this.
No kidding.
But it's fashionable. And that's all that the recent change in regulation means. It's a change in perception of what constitutes a risk.
I guess as well, by having the other two Western countries sort of all of us in alignment, we, people that wonder, oh, I wonder if this is safe, they can see, well, the United States and Britain just did the same thing, so I guess it must be okay.
Well, that's a traditional thing. But then again, you remember that all the industrial countries also still permit the sale of cigarettes and cigars and what have you.
Yeah.
and correspondingly, all of these countries, all of the governments, pay an enormous amount of public money in order to essentially support the farm industry for tobacco. And over and above that, they also pay money to do advertisement that say tobacco is bad for you. So what I think will happen over the next month or years as a result of public pressure is that these three countries, the industrialized countries, will be forced to put breast implants, or for that matter, cosmetic surgery implants that have a history of trouble, into the same bag. And you'll start seeing advertisement that says, well, gee, be careful when you submit to plastic surgery with implants, because sooner or later you're going to be in problems and it's going to cost you a lot of money. And chances are pretty good you may lose your career, and on top of that, you may lose a part of your health. And this is exactly what seems to be the fad today. But there's only one difference. The U.S. does not have a universally funded public health care system. Canada and Britain does.
Hmm.
So what happens, whereas it's money out of your pocket, if you decide to get a breast implant. However, if the whole thing backfires on you and you become one sick puppy, somehow you're going to re-enter the public health system, and you're now going to be costing the public, which is you, me, and everybody else, a lot of money, which could probably be much better spent for other things, perhaps care of the elderly, perhaps cardiac care. But I, for one, do not feel very comfortable with giving my tax money to repair problems which I know are predictable and, in fact, inevitable.
So my next question would be, if Health Canada knows that, you know, there will be problems. Why did they feel the need to lift this ban?
Because of the constituency who wants this, which constitute a very large fragment of the plastic surgery community, what's often termed in the trade a rogue segment. Plastic surgery is not medicine, not universally anyway. Plastic surgery for treatment of burns, children, and deformity, that is something genuine, and that has a lot of merit. It's very hard work. But that is not breast implantation.
Mm.
Breast implantation is a business, and it's a very profitable one. In Canada, the business of implanting breast implants based on available statistic is approximately $3 to $7 million for sales of products alone, gross. But it's $140 to $160 million of surgical business, again, gross. So it follows to reason that there is a very large community who wish to have those implants back in there because they're much easier to implant than the salines, and it's a very good business.
So in your estimation and in your experience, how many women that received implants will get complications from them?
It's not an easy answer to give because you forgot to mention time. If you focus with 1 year after implantation, within 1 year, about 5 to 10% of the users will have already had secondary problems where they have needed to re-enter the healthcare system. After 2 years, the number has increased again. After 3, still more. After 5 years, approximately 1 implant user out of 2 will have justification to have the implant removed because it's doggone uncomfortable, it's ugly, or for some reason she's got a problem which is somehow attributable to the implant. After 10 years, either the patient has become numbed to the problems or to the pain, but in effect, the implant already has lost its usefulness other than to confer volume. After 20 years, the implant is finished, and the implant will have changed much of the tissue around in the chest. So, to put this in a simple statement, the near totality of implant users who manage to live about 20 years after the implantation will almost as a matter of fact have lost their implant, or the implant will be so badly presented that it will no longer fulfill the aims of the reasons why she had it put in the first place.
Did you say
now, this doesn't mean that everyone who has an implant, as ugly as it may be or as painful as it may be, it doesn't mean that she's unhappy with it. I know people who are perfectly happy with sustained pain.
Did you say after 20 years the amount of people that have managed to live?
Implanted persons as a spectrum of people. Everyone does not get an implant at the same age. More and more people of very young age are getting the implant, and this, in my eye, is very bad. But the tradition for, at least as a result of our study, the average age when people got implants in the past up to about 1995 is approximately 33. And not only that, the profile is very uniform. 1 out of 2 implant patients has been divorced at least once. She has 1.3 children, which she has breastfed. So the implanted patient is very uniform on average. But there's another part to it. There are also people who have implants put in later in life for one reason or another, but very few, a trivial fraction, have implants as a result of cancer. And that is a misconception. Less than 5% of the people who bear implants at a given time have it as a result of a mastectomy due to cancer. The bulk of the reason is essentially cosmetics, and that the companies and the surgeons who are in this business will tell you brightly that if it was only for mastectomy patients, they wouldn't be in business at all. It wouldn't pay.
Mm. Something you also mentioned earlier when you were giving the different statistics was that you said after 20 years it will have changed much of the tissue in the chest. What does that
Correct.
Mean?
An implant does not just, a breast implant that is, or for that matter, most implants don't just sit there. They cause the tissue around them to reshape, to reform in a different way. In other words, the implant does not accommodate to the patient. The patient accommodates to the implant. Firstly, the implants become surrounded by a tissue layer which gradually increases in thickness with time. As this layer, think of it as a tissue envelope within containing an implant, the space around the implant that is still within the capsule is usually a liquid. This liquid is stagnant. It's like a marsh. There is no automatic cleansing of this fluid by body processes. So the liquid being stagnant in turn causes death of the surrounding tissue. So as a result, the capsule becomes thicker and thicker. With time, there is less and less cleansing. And after about 10 years, processes that are never found in true living organisms without implants take place. For example, large quantities of very hard glass-like calcific deposits form, and in large amounts. I have seen implants removed after 20 years where the surrounding tissue was like a mass of leather with the inside part consisting of crushed light bulbs. This is not an exception. The near totality of implants that were put in between 1962 to about 1980 that are now being removed come out in this condition. It's not just a statistic risk, it's a guarantee. And the guarantee is that it's the result of the way we are built. Now, it doesn't stop there. A breast implant sits at a crossroad of a lot of machinery. It's not just, the chest is not just a bag of tissue in which you can put anything. When you put an implant into a place like this, you force it between muscles, you have it sit on top of arteries, veins, lymphatic tissue, and what have you. So as a result, all of these other bits of machinery that we call our anatomy are changed as a result. For example, blood flow into the chest is drastically reduced. Part of this blood is part and parcel of our coronary system. Basically, the mammary artery, which is very often very close to these implants, is affected to the point that it ceases to function and it calcifies. And that's, again, an expectation. With time, the implants exert a sustained pressure. It's very much like wearing a corset all of your life. So as a result of this sustained pressure, the rib cage gradually collapses and indents. We have patients where x-rays show incurvation or collapse of individual ribs that sit underneath the implant. And on it goes. It's not rocket science. It's just the way we are made. Our chests were not intended to accommodate a large volume foreign object, which causes changes in the surrounding tissue. It's not an exception. Mm-hmm. It is not a risk. It is a certainty.
Wow, some really sobering information. Thank you very much for having been here and shared that with us and shared your expertise.
You're very welcome.
And where would you recommend is the best place for people to get more information on this subject?
Those of you who have an internet capacity, there are hundreds of websites. By all means, go to all the websites, including those attributable to the manufacturers. And you will see that even the manufacturers are forced to acknowledge that the implants pose chronic problems. And not only that, their documentation, perhaps it may not use the right word. It may say could or may, and whereas it should say will, and definitely will. Mm. But it will still give you an outline of the risks that they pose. Go to plastic surgery websites and compare it to what the manufacturers say. Go to National Health and Welfare and Health Canada websites. And again, you will see that they do cite problems, and they also give guidelines on what people should look for if they ever consider the surgery. But above all, do visit the FDA websites, and the FDA does not mince words. It will say point blank, your insurance policy may very well be canceled on you if you have one of those things put in.
Hmm.
So
wow.
By all means, surf the web and use, above all, your judgment. If it doesn't make sense to you as a layman, it doesn't make sense to a scientist or to a surgeon. It's a fallacy. So above all, do not mistrust your instincts. And there are other places. All those agencies, the FDA, Health Canada, if you send them a postcard asking for info, they'll come back and they'll give you printed material if you don't have a website, a web capacity. And even manufacturers will give you booklets which are not that far from the truth.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Blaise.
You're very welcome.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Dr. Pierre Blaise, who was the senior scientific advisor for 14 years with Canada's Department of National Health and Welfare, which is now Health Canada. He now runs a medical device consultancy firm where he's sent different medical devices, and he looks at their effectiveness and their functioning. Thanks for tuning in.